Welcome to Lady Killers, a podcast about female serial killers. I am your host, Abraham Archambault. Let's go dig up some bodies. Hello, come one, come all. Welcome to this week's episode of Lady Killers. Hope everyone out there is doing great. I'm your host, Abraham Archambault. I'm still hanging in there. A lot of craziness is happening in our country. A lot of it is happening a lot closer to some of us than others. As you've seen on the news probably and things that are happening out there in the world, Portland, which is just down the road from where I am right now, is under attack from our own government, and a lot of people are out there fighting for the city, and this is the city that we all love. You know, I was born in Portland, my children were born here in Portland, and we have a place in our hearts for the city, and we're waiting, and we can't wait for that one day where we can enjoy that great city to its fullest. But you know, a lot of horrible things are happening out there, and I hope we're all staying together and trying to be positive and get through this. But enough about current state of our union. You came here for true crime, and that's what I'm here for. This podcast is a weekly podcast that delves into the murders that some women that we like to call lady killers have committed. I know when this initially started, it was serial killer women, and the more I do research and the more I dig into some of these women, they're not all serial killers. Some of them might have killed only one or two people in the same day. Others, they've done it over time. So more or less, this podcast is becoming just about women killers rather than serial killers. But anyway, this week, I finally returned to the state that I was intending to do before this whole pandemic erupted and began its tear through our country. That state is Arizona, and if you've been following along, you know I was there back in January for the Chandler International Film Festival. And when I was there, I was hoping to visit some of the sites that surround this case we're going to do this week. And things just got too hectic and busy when I was down there, so I never got to do that. I really wish I would have, especially after doing even more research on this topic. But we are going to jump in the Wayback Machine for this one. This week's Lady Killer is pretty popular among Phoenicians down in Arizona. It's actually part of the lore of the city in Phoenix. People seem, if you can take pride in something, they kind of take pride in this murder, even though it's macabre and a horror story. People take pride that it happened in Phoenix. I'm sure there's some other dark things out there in different cities, too, that people call their own and are proud of that from where they come from. But the Lady Killer for this week, she goes by the name Winnie Ruth Judd, also known as the Trunk Murderess. She was born Winnie Ruth McKinnell on January 29th, 1905, in Oxford, Indiana. Her parents were a Methodist minister by the name of H.J. McKinnell and his wife, Carrie. The family attended every church service on Sunday, where there was Pentecostal worship. That's what they practice in her family. And for those that don't know what, you know, Pentecostal worship is, it's you've probably seen it somewhere along the line. It's where, you know, people get baptized in the Holy Spirit and they may flail on the ground, start flopping around and speaking in tongues, as they call it, prophesying. There's exorcism involved in it and a great deal of healing by prayer. Some of these people will not go to a doctor. They will pray over a person that may be sick or injured and hope the Holy Spirit will intervene and save this person. It's an extremely high energy and dynamic form of Christianity, and they're taught to enjoy an empowered life filled with the Holy Spirit. And this can be achieved through the baptism of the Holy Spirit, like I mentioned. And many of you might have seen a preacher on TV like throw a Bible at somebody and just completely hit them with the Holy Spirit. You know, they'll be slain in the Spirit, as they call it. And they'll fall to the floor and they'll start writhing around, speaking in tongues. And this is just kind of painting the picture of where our lady killer, Winnie Ruth Judd, grew up. One thing that I found with her that she just never shook it, and it was always kind of an obsession to her. She always wanted to have a baby. And this was known at least from when she was 7 years old on. I'm not a psychologist. I know there's probably some out there, some armchair psychologists as well, but I'm sure you know what the infatuation was and the obsession. I'm not sure what it is, especially at that age. Maybe it's something deeper than we can fathom. It's a subconscious thing, thinking maybe you can be a better mother than your own mother. I don't know. That's just kind of where it takes me. But it was written at least once when she was around 7 years old that she excitedly blabbed to her neighbor that her mother was pregnant. And when that neighbor came over to Winnie's home to congratulate the mother on the great news, turned out this whole entire story was fabricated by Winnie. It was all just lies that were floating around inside a little child's mind. And there was also another time when Winnie was a little bit older, in her teen years, she accused her boyfriend of knocking her up. Slight problem there. She was still a virgin and had never even been with a boy before. Her boyfriend, or any other boy for that matter. And this was all confirmed when Winnie's parents took her to the doctor and they performed a test. And eventually they said she was actually still a virgin. So when she finally did return home, even though the doctors told her parents she was not pregnant and that she was still a virgin, when she finally did return, she claimed that she said she was pregnant. She was kidnapped by people that wanted her baby. So they kidnapped her. And once she had given birth to the baby, they stole it from her and just left her there. A baby was never found. And again, after all this, her parents took her back to the doctor to get her examined. And they said she was never pregnant. And it was all just something that was in her imagination. Quite an imagination for this lady killer. And those lies, similar in fashion, would continue through her schooling days. Winnie's parents felt that it was best that she should get a job, start working, to keep her busy, keep her mind out of the clouds. And so she went to work at the Indiana State Hospital as an attendant. And this is where she would meet her future husband, Dr. William C. Judd. And at this time, she was about 17 years old. Dr. Judd and Winnie would soon be married, and he whisked her away to New Orleans for their honeymoon. Dr. William C. Judd was a veteran of the First World War, and he was nearly 30 years older than Winnie. So right off the bat, here we go. We got another guy snatching up one of our lady killers when she was still a child. And he was old enough to be her father easily. I know this was common back in the day. It still just still doesn't sit right with me, and it never has, and it never will, that a 17, 18-year-old girl can be snatched up by a guy that's in his 40s, almost 50. It just doesn't seem right to me, because he would have been almost 50 years old when he married Winnie. So Winnie took his last name and became Winnie Ruth Judd, and they ran off to live in Mexico, where her husband William was going to be employed as a doctor with a large mining company down there. It was documented that William had a real bad morphine addiction, and that had all started when he was being treated for some of the injuries he had sustained in World War I. And that morphine addiction led to William having an extremely hard time keeping a job and making money for the family. And it also caused them to move around frequently looking for work. So, you know, they were constantly left with this feeling of never really knowing when the next payday was coming, where your food was coming from, anything like that. Kind of similar to how we're living today because of our government. But this was all due to Dr. Judd. He was not religiously affiliated. And so that was probably a big shock to Winnie, who grew up in a Pentecostal environment, as I said, very energetic, dynamic. So this unstable system that Winnie was brought into was probably a shock. She was pretty hardcore Christian, so, you know, it was probably pretty tough to go into that role and just be this person that floated around with no religion, nothing, basically, to guide you. Her mind never wavered from the idea of being a mother. That was the one thing she still always wanted to do, was get pregnant. But William was so caught up in his morphine addiction, which also turned into alcoholism. So he added that to his repertoire, and he just didn't want to bring a child into the world. He didn't like the idea of it, and he felt that Winnie should get on some sort of birth control so this would not be an issue in the future. At that time, the only foolproof way to avoid becoming pregnant was abstinence, and, you know, there wasn't much to do back then, so most couples were not practicing abstinence. They were staying pretty busy in the bedroom. The most popular form of birth control, if you were going to avoid the abstinence route, was the spermicidal jelly that was created back in that time. Dr. Judd was under the impression that Winnie was using this jelly every time that they were engaging in sex, and this was not the case. She would pretend to do it, or, you know, I've heard this story before. She would say that she was. It's like a guy when he says, "Oh yeah, I wore a rubber, don't worry about it." Winnie was always telling her husband she was using that jelly. In fact, she wasn't, and soon found herself pregnant. That was a huge no-no for Dr. Judd, and he proceeded to tell her how he felt she was emotionally unstable, and she was still so immature and shouldn't have a baby. Well, what the hell do you expect when you cradle rob, you know? Of course she's not mature enough to have a baby yet. You're almost grandfather age, and you're marrying this teenager still, so what do you expect as far as immaturity goes? At any rate, she had manipulated him into having a baby, which is explicitly he had told her he didn't want. And so this would lead Dr. Judd to perform an abortion on her. And, I mean, that just sounds totally brutal. I don't think Winnie ever recovered mentally from that. You know, a forced abortion, taking away the one thing that you had wanted since you were 7 years old. I can't see how she would hold up from something like that. And she soon found herself in a deep depression. She eventually became pregnant a second time, again without William's approval. This time she knew the only way to bring the child to term would be to run away and have the baby somewhere else safe. Before she could do that, she miscarried. So she's had a forced abortion and right away a miscarriage. The only thing she wanted in life was to be a mother, and it just wasn't happening. And so she returned back to her husband, William Judd. Not long after that, William lost his job in that Mexican mine, and it forced the couple to move back to the United States. They settled just across the border in Laredo, Texas. But William just couldn't shake that horrible addiction he had to morphine, so he ended up selling basically all of their possessions, including their car, just to score some dope. And after years of trying to get her husband clean, Winnie just, she had had enough. That was the final straw. After he had sold the car and everything, they were unable to reconcile the relationship, and she just snapped, and she left that cradle robber to move to Phoenix. William, on the other hand, would head out to LA to start his own medical practice. Upon arriving in Phoenix, Winnie soon found herself employed as a governess to a wealthy family in the city. And a governess is basically a teacher in a way that basically teaches her children, instead of going to school. It's like a live-in teacher that they had back in the day then. And I'm assuming if somebody hired Winnie to do this job, they thought she was intelligent enough and coherent enough to do the job. But let's put a pin in that, because we'll continue on here. But just remember the state of her mind, because that's going to become a factor later on in this story. At this time, Winnie Judd would have been, I think, 25 years old. Basically single and ready to mingle, as they say. She had gainful employment and a place over her head, and it seemed like she was off to a great start without her husband, Dr. Judd. And during her time as that governess in Phoenix, she met a wealthy businessman by the name of John J. Happy Jack Halloran. He was a 44-year-old playboy, married, but was known for his philandering ways around town. He made his presence known around town as a pretty successful businessman. He owned many, many lumber yards around Phoenix. He was known as a mover and a shaker, and hung out with the elites and all the political figures of the city. But like I say, he was known for his philandering ways. He was a married man, but I don't think he really hid it too much that he really loved women. So it's no surprise that he soon became involved with Winnie Judd. So apparently they got mixed up in an extramarital affair during this whole time, and kind of slowly start to set Winnie on this path where she becomes obsessed with old Happy Jack Halloran. After a few months into the affair with Happy Jack Halloran, Winnie left her job as governess, and she gained employment at Grunau Medical Clinic in Phoenix as a receptionist, or secretary, as they used to call it. And this is where she would meet the two women that would eventually turn her world upside down and forever change her life. The women she instantly became friends with were an x-ray technician from Oregon by the name of Agnes Ann LeRoy, and her roommate Hedvig Samuelson, who came from North Dakota. They recently had moved to the Phoenix area from Alaska, where they were hanging out together. Hedvig was diagnosed with tuberculosis, and they both felt that moving to a drier climate would help out, you know, help alleviate some of the symptoms of TB. And so they moved down there to Phoenix, and the three women became close friends in no time. They were all relatively the same age. Ann LeRoy was the oldest, 6 years older than Winnie, and then Hedvig was a couple years younger than Winnie. So basically, they, you know, same age group, they had a lot in common. LeRoy and Samuelson were already living together in this little bungalow, kind of around the corner from where Winnie was living in an apartment all by herself. So, you know, the two women invited Winnie to move in with them, which would make total sense. They could cut down on living expenses. They all seemed to get along real well with each other, so, you know, they would have good conversations, have some nice little cocktail parties, and, you know, it would be win-win for everybody involved. I mean, this is only an episode of Lady Killers. What could possibly go wrong? There was one link among the three women, and that was the old womanizer Happy Jack Halloran. They all seemed to know him in one way or another, which a lot of people did, since he was a pretty prominent figure in the Phoenix area. We know that Winnie Judd was having an affair with him, so that's the connection that she had with Happy Jack. The other two, LeRoy and Samuelson, they were alleged to be a couple, and in 1931, lesbianism, as they were calling it, it was highly frowned upon. You couldn't, like today, you can walk down the street, women holding hands, you know, showing their affection towards one another. That couldn't be done back in 1931. So this begs the question, what were these two lesbians doing hanging around with a pig like Happy Jack? I mean, he was known to be a womanizer. But it did eventually become known that they were kind of just using him for his money, power, and influence around the city. Maybe they were just enjoying each other's company in the privacy of, in their own home, in the closet, if you will, which is pretty common for back then. People that were homosexual had to hide the fact that they were homosexual from everybody, or it could affect their entire life. So they kind of had to be in the closet and live a lie most of the time. They also, around the town, there was a theory that was floated about that the two girls were bisexual, and that also they did have some sort of sexual connection to Happy Jack Halloran. Ann LeRoy had been married twice already to a man, so it's quite possible. Or it's just that, like I said, at that time, you just had to live a lie. You had to pretend you were somebody else. You had to pretend you liked men, if you really didn't. And vice versa with men, too. Lots of men got married to a woman, even though they were gay, living in the closet. So, you know, that's just another theory that they were using Jack for his money. And all the while just being in love with each other. But anyway, there were quite a few parties that they all threw in that little bungalow. They spent a few months together. A lot of times Jack Halloran would actually show up at the place. He would bring over a bunch of his, you know, these married guys, kind of pal around with the girls. This was all during the Prohibition time, so alcohol was illegal. So Halloran was, he had a connection to bootleg booze, and so he would bring that over to their bungalow, and they would all party down with illegal booze. All the men that were there hanging around, they were all married, but they would provide the women with gifts and money, trying to kind of bribe them into sexual favors and that sort of thing. But all their eyes were on Jack Halloran. For some reason, they just flocked to him, even though these other guys were, you know, trying to woo them. It just wasn't working. They were really into Jack Halloran, and they were always fighting over his affections. And apparently, Winnie thought that she was his girlfriend or something, and I think she became extremely jealous when she found out that one night Leroy and Samuelson were partying with Jack when Winnie wasn't even around. And so Winnie got very jealous. The idea of those three women living together as roommates was very short-lived because of all that. The week following the breakup of those roommates, Winnie wrote numerous letters to her estranged husband, Dr. William Judd, complaining on end about her experiences with Anne and Hedwig and how upset she was over the entire ordeal. She even mentioned in one letter that she felt like she was, quote, going crazy, and that, quote, Anne was making her crazy, end quote. I seriously doubt that she mentioned to her estranged husband that she was actually involved with Happy Jack Halloran herself. Since Winnie, William, they were both still married, I don't think he would have been too happy with that fact if he would have known. And then, on an ordinary Friday night, out in the desert of Phoenix, on October 16th, 1931, Anne Leroy called up Winnie to see if she might be interested in getting together with Hedwig and another girl. They were looking to get together for, you know, some drinks and to play some cards at that home that the three used to share together. Winnie was hesitant at first. There was still some jealousy, and some bad blood was still lingering in the air between all of them, I think. But Anne persisted, and I don't know, maybe she was having a change of heart, and she wanted to clear the air among the three girls and maybe possibly become friends again. I don't know, but Winnie insisted she had too much to do at home that night, and she declined the invitation. She instead called up Jack Halloran, that womanizing lush, and invited him to come hang out with her. Of course, he gladly accepted the invitation, and he promised to be over at about 8 or 9 o'clock. Winnie patiently waited as 8 o'clock rolled around, 9 o'clock rolled around, still no Jack, and she soon became very impatient and eventually very pissed off when he never showed up at all. So Winnie Judd, with nothing better to do, headed over to Leroy and Samuelson's house about 10 o'clock that evening. And she was just pissed off and sad, and she just needed a shoulder to cry on. And Leroy and Hedwig Samuelson welcomed her with open arms. And they even invited her to spend the night that night. She said they could just hang out, gossip, eat some snacks, have a few drinks, and just badmouth that all the womenizing creeps that have abounded throughout history. But sometime during the evening, the topic of Happy Jack Halloran came up. It was apparent that he was seen around town with a new hussy by the name of Lucille Moore, and the rumor with Lucille Moore was that she had syphilis, and she was being treated for that at the clinic, unbeknownst to Halloran himself. So she had been going into the clinic, she was tested, and it was confirmed, supposedly, she had syphilis. That would have been the clinic where Winnie probably, I think she knew who this girl was too, this new girl by the name of Lucille Moore. All because of this girl, this argument broke out between Anne, Hedwig, and Winnie. It seemed to be over Jack, like they were fighting over this guy. They were fighting just, you know, who loved him more and who did he love the most? Kind of like, it just seemed like such a petty argument, almost like something that would happen in middle school or high school or something. They're fighting over this guy who, he was just using all of them anyway. I don't know, so silly it seemed, but, you know, Winnie, she claimed she knew everything about that Lucille girl in her health history, but she didn't want to tell anybody because she had strong convictions, and she said that would be an ethics violation if she, you know, told any information about that. She insisted that Jack and Lucille were just friends. Nothing else was going on there. And it looked like Anne and Hedwig basically laughed in her face after she said that. So confidently she said that about Jack and Lucille's relationship. They laughed in her face. And Anne even went as far as saying she was going to spill it all to Jack the next time she saw him. She was going to tell him about Lucille, that she had syphilis, and Winnie countered that with a threat of her own. She said if they didn't shut their mouths, she would tell the whole world that the rumors of their lesbianism, they were all true, and that the two were madly in love with each other. And after barking out all of her threats, Winnie stormed out of the room into a little breakfast nook area to calm down. And while she was in there trying to calm down, out of nowhere, Hedwig Samuelson appeared waving a gun in Winnie's face. She told Winnie that she'd better shut her mouth if she knew what was good for her. There better not be any more rumors about her and Anne's sexual orientation floating around, or Winnie was going to get her pretty face loaded up with lead. Apparently, this was Winnie's gun, too, that she was flashing in her face that she had left behind a week earlier when she moved out. So Winnie lunged forward to try to slap the gun from Hedvig's hand, and it caused the two to fall to the ground, and they wrestled around on the floor all over that breakfast nook, back and forth, each trying to gain the upper hand and secure the gun. From out of nowhere, Anne comes running in with an ironing board and took a huge whack right at Winnie's back with it, knocking it to the ground. And seeing how it momentarily stunned Winnie, Anne proceeded to just beat the shit out of Winnie with this ironing board, just over and over again. And all the while, she's screaming out, "Shoot her, Sammy, shoot!" And later on, when Winnie was being processed by the authorities, they would note that her body was covered, in fact, with over 100 bruises. And that would confirm Winnie's story of being beaten by the ironing board. So during the melee, as both were trying to obtain the gun, Winnie was shot in the hand, while Sammy was shot in the chest, collapsing to the floor. Sammy also goes by the name Hedvig, so that's the same person, in case we get confused here. And after the smoke cleared, Winnie saw that she somehow magically had the gun in her hand. And realizing what had just happened, and still just feeling the pain from that beating she took from Anne and the ironing board, Winnie pointed that gun right at her and killed her instantly as well. So Winnie had just murdered two women in cold blood. So Winnie had just murdered two women in cold blood with a gun that could be linked back to her. Winnie, still reeling from the shock of it all, decided quickly she needed to race home, change her clothes, and then she was going to call her husband, Dr. Judd, to see what she needed to do next. After Winnie made it back to her apartment and changed into something less murdery, she began contemplating her next move. Before she could even call her husband, William, old Happy Jack Halloran showed up at her house, just wasted out of his mind. We all know what he was looking for. She cut him off right away and related the whole story to him. He didn't believe it. How could this little lady, this little girl he was banging around, how could she blast away two other women he was banging? But Winnie convinced Halloran to accompany her back to Anne and Sammy's home to confirm what had happened. And upon arrival back at the home, Winnie and Jack found the two bodies laying in the breakfast nook dead, just as Winnie had left them. The inebriated Jack bolted right into action, shut all the lights off, he closed the blinds, and then he checked the pulses of both women and verified that they were in fact dead. So he picked up Sammy first and he carried her to the bedroom and placed her on the bed. And later on, according to Winnie, she would say that Jack really paid a lot of attention to Sammy during this whole ordeal, making sure he was being so sensitive and attentive to this dead body of Sammy. But what do you expect? I mean, he had just lost his favorite filly. So Winnie started to clean the house. She tried to remove any evidence of her even being in the house. And then she picked up the phone to call her husband, but Happy Jack screamed at her to put the phone down. He was going to take care of everything. She should just stop thinking, basically. Don't do anything. He was going to make sure nobody found out who did this. But I think, more importantly, what he was trying to do is distance himself completely from this relationship. He was, like I say, still a married guy and a very prominent figure in the Phoenix area. And I think this would have really, you know, put a black mark on his entire existence in Phoenix. I don't think he was very concerned with these dead ladies that one of his mistresses had shot. I think he was just trying to save face. So he ordered Winnie to run out to the garage and grab a steamer trunk that he had seen out there, bring it on in, because he was going to shove the bodies into there. And according to Winnie, Jack told her they would, quote, "put the bodies in that and I'll bring them out to the desert," end quote. So Winnie retrieved the steamer trunk and brought it back in, and Jack told her, "You need to go back to work the following day." This would avoid raising any suspicions. He wanted everything to seem like it was just the same everyday nonsense that goes on. She was also trying to avoid calling anybody, especially her husband, She just wanted to pretend like everything was going back to normal. Meanwhile, Happy Jack helped Winnie bandage her hand up, because remember, Winnie got shot during that scuffle with Sammy, so she still had a bullet in her hand, and so she returned back home and waited for Happy Jack's call. So shortly after Winnie arrived at home, Happy Jack Halloran called her up, and he told her he didn't dispose of those bodies like he promised he would. He told her she was going to have to deal with all the bodies all by herself. He said he was still working on some sort of plan to get her out of this, and there was this guy named Mr. Wilson that he had been speaking to, and he said there was this elaborate plan that it was, he was going to figure it all out. Winnie was supposed to go retrieve the bodies after she got off work the following day and then put them in that steamer trunk. She was then supposed to go to the train station and head out towards Los Angeles, and that's where she would meet this mystery man, Mr. Wilson, and he would help dispose of those bodies on the beach. She crammed the bodies of Hedvig Samuelson and Anne LeRoy into the steamer trunk, and then she called in a man that would deliver them to the train station for her. Apparently, when he arrived, he said she was pacing back and forth in complete darkness, except for maybe a couple candles that were lit. And he said he was a little weirded out by this, and she told him it was just because she was moving out, and she had already had the electricity turned off. And he bought that story and conducted the rest of their business by candlelight. But unfortunately, the delivery man informed Winnie that the trunk was too heavy for transport unless she paid a hefty fee for the overage. And she was broke, couldn't pay the extra fee, so she just paid the delivery man to deliver the trunk to her apartment. And she would figure out what to do with it after that. So, with the delivery man on his way to her apartment, this left Winnie to deal with the two dead bodies all by herself, figure out what to do with them once she got back to her apartment, which is something, in my opinion, she should have done anyway, since she is the one that decided to kill them. So now we have Winnie sitting all alone back at her apartment, staring at this large steamer trunk filled with the dead bodies of her old roommates. She tried to ring up Happy Jack many, many times, but of course he didn't answer on any one of those attempts. This seems to be the case with many of our lady killers that we've done. Usually, they've been brainwashed or led on by these men pigs. Especially back in the 1930s, women were not treated as well as they are today, if you can use that term. I still don't think they're being treated as well as they should be. But back in the 1930s, it was much, much worse than it is today. These animals would squeeze all the life out of their victims. And in this case, it was Winnie and her two dead roommates. Happy Jack had already used them all up and he'd spit them out. And since all he cared about was his public image, he had abandoned Winnie and left her to deal with whatever mess was left over to clean up herself. Winnie decided the only way to avoid paying the overage fee for shipping the bodies on the train was to, of course, chop them up and separate them into multiple pieces of luggage. Apparently, if you did that, if you had multiple lightweight pieces of luggage, you could ship those no problem without any overage fees to pay. Sammy was chopped up first and put into various pieces of luggage, a small suitcase, a smaller trunk, and then a hat box. And then Anne LeRoy, she got to stay folded up in the steamer trunk because she fit well enough in there. And then Winnie threw in some other evidence, some letters she had written, anything that would convict her she threw into that trunk because she assumed this was all going to disappear and it would all, after being disposed of, it would never lead back to her, and she could live her life as normal. At this point, though, you got to start thinking, you know, all the reports show that Winnie was just very slender and frail. She also had suffered from TB most of her life, so, I mean, is it possible she could have done all this by herself, chopped the bodies up? Those steamer trunks back then in those days were god-awful, man. They were heavy. And so a lot of people claim there's no way she could have done this without assistance from somebody else. I personally think she probably could have done it all alone, because determined and frightened people, they somehow can conjure up some strength sometimes, and strength they didn't even know they had, physically and mentally. But on the other hand, I also know that Jack Halloran was the type of guy that would, he was trying to distance himself from the situation anyway. So he possibly could have aided in concealing the bodies. I think he did At one point, I think he at least saw the dead bodies and knew it was happening. But he would claim she was just another dim-witted secretary who got into it with her roommates. And unfortunately, people got shot. But it's still unclear whether Halloran helped chop up Sammy and load her up or not. Regardless of who participated in what, Winnie took the train to Los Angeles with her plethora of goodies. And upon arrival, she was supposed to meet up with that mysterious man, Mr. Wilson. But guess what? He never showed up. Now, this was either because A, he wasn't a real person in the first place, B, Winnie had been duped by Happy Jack Halloran, or C, he wasn't there because dummy, absent-minded Winnie, she arrived a day later than she had told Jack that she was supposed to arrive, so if there was supposed to be a Mr. Wilson waiting, she was a day late, so he wouldn't have been there anyway. There's also another option. All of the above are correct, so we really don't know at that point. What we do know was there was a little problem with the luggage because it royally reeked at this point and it started to ooze a dark red liquid from it. Just imagine how nasty that would have been. I mean, they were essentially turning into jelly as the moments were passing, you know, and the authorities at the train station noticed right away, and they noticed a nasty smell emitting from the luggage, and they demanded the key from Winnie so they could examine the contents. Winnie, of course, she pretended to frantically search around for a key, but you guessed it, she came up empty-handed. And then she just kind of walked away, leaving that steaming, odorous luggage behind. So Winnie then called up her brother, Burton McKinnell, and she asked for a ride. And her brother Burton, without question and oblivious to what Winnie had just participated in, picked her up and drove her out into Los Angeles, where she would disappear for about a week. And she apparently wandered the streets, trying to stay low and stay invisible. She even walked all the way out to Pasadena and Altadena, which is over a 10-mile trek from where she had started. In Altadena, she made her way to La Vina Sanitarium, where she had been a tuberculosis patient a few years earlier, so she was familiar with the area and familiar with the place. And she managed to find an abandoned cottage on site, and that's where she set up shop for 2 days. Remember, too, all of this was done with her hand with a bullet lodged in it, which was, at this point, gangrene. Gangrene had started on it, so by this time, Winnie was the talk of the town around Los Angeles. The story was making its way through the city, plastered all over the paper, and Winnie was given some great nicknames in the press, as the press tends to do. She was called Tiger Woman and the Blonde Butcher in the papers, but the case would end up being called the Trunk Murders, and Winnie would be known as the Trunk Murderess. She said she even heard people in passing as they read the newspaper out loud to each other. And one line in particular is what would grab a hold of her conscience. And it stated, quote, "Here's the number to call, Winnie." Quote. It had addressed her specifically. So, and then underneath that, there was a phone number that she should call if she came across this and wanted to turn herself in. But first, she called her husband, William Judd, and just spilled her guts to him, told him everything that happened. And then she called the number in the newspaper. And through all this, William, her husband, sent a guy out to pick her up and then brought her back to Alvarez and Moore Funeral Chapel, where the murderess and her estranged husband were reunited at once. And shortly after, police arrived to take her into custody. The paparazzi swarmed that funeral home as Our Lady Killer, Winnie Judd, emerged from inside. She was dressed in a luxurious fur coat, and the people that were present said she looked like she was like posing for these pictures like a Hollywood movie star on the red carpet. And she looked, quote, "glamorous, beautiful, very cinematic," end quote. And this is where America would begin their infatuation with the trunk murderess, Winnie Ruth Judd. I looked at the pictures. I reviewed those photos that were taken as she was descending the steps of the funeral home. And if I didn't know any better, I would have thought that it was the latest movie star posing on the red carpet. That's exactly what it looks like. I mean, I hate to say it, but she looked stunning. She most definitely didn't look like someone who had just days earlier killed her two friends in cold blood, chopping up one of them and smashing it into a luggage. I mean, she didn't look like that at all, but does anybody ever look like the killer that they are? This case caused pandemonium around Phoenix. The landlord at the home where the murders took place began to charge citizens of Phoenix to take a tour of the murder site. He actually took an ad out in the Arizona Republic and the Phoenix Evening Gazette, charging 10 cents for each person to visit the crime scene. And this was only a day after the police had conducted their investigation of the murder site. But also, it was known that the actual day of the investigation, as police officers and detectives were going through, neighbors and just random people off the street, news reporters, they were allowed into the crime scene and just wandered around to look at it while it was still being investigated. I mean, that's such a blatant disregard for securing and maintaining the integrity of a crime scene. And I know it does happen occasionally today, but for the most part, that would not fly today, and there would be immediately be a mistrial in something like that. So the police came to the conclusion that Winnie Judd had shot the victims while they slept in their beds, not during a scuffle, as Winnie insisted. They found one of the mattresses miles away from the home, with there was no signs of blood or anything out of the ordinary on them, and then the other mattress was missing from the home, but it was never found. And they had never given an explanation as to why the mattresses were taken from the home in the first place. This was just the police trying to come up with a reason to pin it all on Winnie, I believe. So the trial of Winnie Ruth Judd commenced on January 19th, 1932, at the Maricopa County Courthouse in Phoenix, Arizona. Judge Howard C. Speakman presided. And one interesting fact that I found out that each juror, before the trial started, they were asked if they knew who Jack Halloran was. Strange question, I think. I can't imagine why they asked if they knew who Halloran was, but it does remind me of those old mobster and mafia movies where you see the mobster hanging around the courthouse trying to show his dominance, you know, trying to instill fear in all the jurors as they, you know, as he tries to manipulate the trial with those puppet strings. And I mean, Jack Halloran showed up every single day for the trial, but he was never called as a witness or anything. So what was he doing there? And why were the jurors asked who this guy was if nobody thought he had any involvement? Why were they asking that? I think the jurors would have been scared out of their minds of Happy Jack Halloran, because I think he had more pull than we want to realize. I think he was involved in some stuff, and I think he was trying to scare those jurors into just convicting Winnie and moving on and having everybody forget about this whole case. Not everyone seemed to think she was guilty, though. William Randolph Hearst, the famous newspaper magnate, put up $20,000 for her defense fund. And that would be over $300,000 today. So she took that money and immediately hired a new hotshot lawyer who she thought was going to come in and save her life. But the only caveat in that $20,000 being put up for Winnie was that she was to allow Hearst exclusivity when it came to reporting her life story. And she eventually did write a biography for Hearst. And he just made stacks and stacks of money off all the newspapers that were flying off the stands during the trial. The prosecution went after Winnie with premeditated murder charges, while she remained confident in her self-defense plea. They claimed all the defensive wounds on her body were self-inflicted, even though, as I stated earlier, if you remember, the medical examiner reported that she was beaten with an ironing board. And they said there was at least 100 bruises that matched up with an ironing board. And I don't see how somebody can do that to themselves. So who did beat her over 100 times, leaving those bruises? There's no way she could have done that herself. And I don't think she would have had Happy Jack do that either. I mean, that's beyond brutal. So I don't know. Prosecutors claim that Winnie also actually shot herself in the hand so she could later prove that it was self-defense. I mean, it started to get pretty elaborate, some of the things that they said that Winnie did. And they said Winnie did this all over a man. And those women, the three women, had fought in the past over men, so it wasn't so far-fetched of an idea, you know. And they said it was in a jealous rage that she went to the home already intending to murder these women who stood in her way. And I guess the trial at that point, it was just complete total circus, chaos. They said the evidence wasn't even reliable. Winnie's testimony was questionable at best. And the press was running rampant with whatever little tidbit they could come across. They even reported something, a little funny story that was written about her, because she had to have surgery on her gangrenous hand to remove the bullet that had been lodged in there for a few days. She was heavily sedated, and she was reported as saying, quote, "I had to fight them. You would have fought too. I fought so hard," end quote. But through all of that nonsense that surrounded the trial, on February 8th, 1932, Winnie Ruth Judd was found guilty and she was sentenced to die by hanging. And the hanging was to take place the following year on February 17th, 1933. So she was shipped off to the Arizona State Prison out in Florence to await her execution the following year. At this point, after she had already been sentenced to die, Winnie just, she'd finally had enough of protecting Happy Jack Halloran, so she was going to introduce him into the mix. And she claimed that he was supposed to protect her, and he swore he was going to keep her out of jail if she exonerated him, but clearly he didn't do that. He did not protect her at all. So now it was payback time for Winnie. Jack Halloran was indicted by a grand jury to determine if he in fact was an accessory to the murders. Winnie testified against him, and she blurted out at one point that she was, quote, "going to be hanged for something Jack Halloran is responsible for. I was convicted of murder, but I shot in self-defense. Jack Halloran removed every bit of evidence. He is responsible for me going through all this. He is guilty of anything I am guilty of," end quote. Halloran's attorney told the jury that Judd's testimony was simply, quote, "the story of an insane person, and any charges against Happy Jack should be dropped." But if it was self-defense, as Winnie insisted, that meant that there was no crime for Halloran to be found guilty of. And so on January 25th, 1933, the judge announced that Jack Halloran was not guilty of homicide, but acted out in self-defense. So that piece of garbage walked out of that courthouse as a free man. And Winnie, still the same, unfortunately for her, she was still to be executed as planned. So it was clear that the married womanizer, Jack Halloran, had a lot of pull in the community, or else he wouldn't have walked out of there a free man. He was obviously trying to distance himself from the whole situation, to pretend like he didn't even know who Winnie Judd was. You know, after everything went down, or, you know, she would have been free alongside him. If he cared about her at all, she should have been free with him, but he couldn't let her walk free. She knew too much, I think, and it's like I said earlier, you know, he just used women for his own sick desires, and then he tossed them aside when he was done with them. He was such a scumbag that he was going to watch this woman be led to the gallows to be hung until she was dead. This woman that he used and abused just to save face and keep his powerful stature in the community around Phoenix. But a little side note here that might make some of you happy. Jack Halloran pretty quickly fell out of favor with the city of Phoenix. He slowly lost clients and pretty much most of his business associates. They distanced themselves from him, and he was knocked down off of this pedestal that he was on. Lost his social status, and pretty soon after that, he had to leave Phoenix for good. This poor, misogynistic, womanizing douche, Jack Halloran, moved to Tucson, and he died not long after, in 1939. As the days of Winnie's execution approached, the sheriff of the jail, where Winnie was incarcerated, worked on blocking her execution. He didn't want to see Winnie Ruth Judd die for a crime that she had committed due to the fact that she was mentally ill. So he was working on trying to find some loopholes throughout this whole ordeal, trying to desperately save Winnie's life. And he even had her write another confession, but this time he kind of instructed her to rant and rave like a lunatic to kind of try to show that she was, in fact, insane. And she also added new information that wasn't previously mentioned in any other confession or during the trial. And her new confession stated she was addicted to this drug, Luminol, and that was making her crazy, and, you know, somehow it made something snap inside her brain, and That's what caused her to visit Ann and Sammy with the gun. And I looked up that drug because I didn't know what it was. And it basically, it's the same as a phenobarbital, which is, it's a medicine that's supposed to be used to control seizures. But I know a lot of people do abuse it. You know, if you're going through withdrawals from that drug, it's very common to experience hallucinations. So if she was taking that drug and maybe she was experiencing some hallucinations at the time, I don't know. Maybe she had a mental episode when it all went down and it just kind of collapsed around her. Winnie Ruth Judd was given an insanity hearing because of that. Eventually she was found mentally insane and she was shipped off to the Arizona State Asylum for the Insane. Later they changed the name of that to the Arizona State Hospital. So for the next 40 years, Winnie would find herself locked up in the state hospital. And she was very well loved on the inside. She was considered to be the resident hairdresser in the hospital. And it was said that it was actually a privilege to get your hair done by Winnie Judd. Also during that 40-year span, she escaped at least 6 times. Apparently the nurses loved her so much, they provided her with a key to the front door of the hospital. In one escape, she made it all the way to Yuma, Arizona, which is just shy of 200 miles away, where she just followed the train tracks outside of the hospital all the way down to Yuma. There was also another epic escape that lasted 6 entire years. And Winnie found herself employed as a nurse to a wealthy lady in a mansion that overlooked the San Francisco Bay. And during this time, she went by the name Marion Lane. This wealthy family, like everyone at that state hospital, just adored Winnie. They loved her. They loved her so much that the woman willed tons of money in an entire house, all to Winnie. But unfortunately, Winnie would never see a dime of that. One of her nephews had been blackmailing her the whole time during her furlough from the hospital. She was supposed to be locked up in the hospital, so he was threatening to turn her in all the time if she wasn't handing over her paychecks to him. So this whole time he's extorting her. But finally, Winnie refused to pay him any longer, so his threat became a reality, and authorities showed up at that wealthy woman's house on August 18th, 1969, and Winnie was taken back into custody and shipped off immediately to the Arizona State Hospital. Not long after arriving back at the hospital, Winnie hired a defense attorney by the name of Melvin Belly to help her get out of the hospital. He, in turn, brought on a tough team of lawyers to help in Winnie's parole. And they worked vigorously, and sure enough, on December 22nd, 1971, Winnie was paroled after 40 years of living, quote, under the shadow of the noose, end quote. And then furthermore, in 1983, the state of Arizona declared an absolute discharge of the case, which meant she was no longer a parolee and she was allowed to live her life as she pleased. Winnie Ruth Judd moved to Stockton, California, where she would live out a long life. She actually made it to October 23rd, 1998. That's when she eventually just expired from an old age. She was actually 93 years old at the time of her death. An interesting fact in that is the day that she died was exactly 67 years since her surrender to the police in L.A. back on those steps of the funeral home in 1931. 67 years exactly to the day. I only mention that just because I find stuff like that so interesting, how, I don't know if you want to call it fate or your destiny works out like that, but 67 years to the day. Winnie's involvement in the murders of Ann LaRoy and Hedvig Samuelson were always questioned throughout history. Many think that she was covering up for that pig Halloran and others who may have been involved in the case. Later on, people came forward claiming that they had seen Jack Halloran's car outside the murder scene the day of the murder and subsequent days after. There's also supposedly a confession letter that was written by Winnie that was found in 1933, where she took full responsibility for the killings. And I don't know, maybe she wrote the letter because she actually was feeling remorse for the killings and she was trying to clear her conscience, or I don't know, maybe she was coerced to write it. But, Winnie is now deceased, so we'll probably never know if that was a real letter. They said it was in her handwriting, but maybe somebody coerced her to write it. We'll never know, but I believe Winnie Ruth Judd was in fact the murderer of those women. I think she did it. I don't know if it was in self-defense, as she claimed. I think all three women, they were all jealous of each other. They were seeking affections from the same man, and some words were said. Some shit-talking was going on, and Winnie just couldn't handle it anymore. And she was so madly in love with that scumbag, Jack Halloran, that she just wasn't thinking straight. This was definitely a crime of passion, and I'm not on Winnie's side. She's still a murderer, but I, as in many cases, I think she was brainwashed by a horrible man. It happens a lot among our lady killers, and among all you women out there. I know sometimes, these men try to brainwash you and try to make you think they have your best intentions in mind, and they actually don't. I think the mode of transporting those bodies was all Jack's idea at the murder scene. I think he probably did help a little bit in putting those bodies into the luggage, but I think Winnie was probably right there with him, and they were loading him up together. Like I said, he was always trying to just eliminate any connection with himself and those women and Winnie, and he wasn't going to let it jeopardize this glorious life he was living in Phoenix. Once Winnie and that luggage was going to leave town, he could be done with it all. He was going to wash his hands. You know, thank God, though, that goddamn lonely loser was run out of town, and he just died lonely and a loser down in Tucson. And it's funny that Winnie made it to almost 100 years old while he died just a few years after the whole case. So he got a little bit of payback there, I think. But at any rate, that is the case of Winnie Ruth Judd, our lady killer of this week from Arizona. I want to thank you all so much for listening. Feel free to send any comments or questions to the email address for this podcast, which is theladykillerspod@gmail.com. If you want to just let us know how we're doing here, if there's any lady killers from your neck of the woods that you would like me to discuss on an upcoming episode, let me know. You can also visit our production website at 1129productions.com, where you can visit it for any updates on this podcast, as well as news and updates on my screenplay, Loon Lake. And you can also still purchase that on Amazon as we speak. I'll leave all this info in the notes for the podcast as well. And if you feel so inclined, also you can contribute to this podcast in the link that's provided. Obviously, not a requirement to donate any money at all, especially during these trying times we're going through. This podcast is going to remain free no matter what for your enjoyment, whether anyone contributes or not. But I do want to let you all know it is so much appreciated, every single donation that comes through. So there's another episode in the books with another one on the way shortly. Please continue to take care of each other out there on this rocky road that is now America. But just don't let hate win. Continue to social distance, wash your hands, and wear that mask. If we continue to do our part, hopefully this thing will be more manageable as each day passes. You should probably go out there, say hello to a neighbor or a friend, make sure they're doing okay, you know. And as the incomparable Mahatma Gandhi once said, quote, "You must not lose faith in humanity. Humanity is an ocean. If a few drops of the ocean are dirty, the ocean does not become dirty." End quote. Stay safe, friends. I'm your grateful host, Abraham Archambault. I hope you have sweet dreams.